Escape Pod 180. October 17th, 2008. Today's story, Navy Brat, by Kay Kenyon.
Hello and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. We get a pretty diverse range of feedback and criticism here, but there are a few common themes that tend to crop up over and over. One is that we really ought to have more young adult fiction. Another is that we don't run enough military SF. We're talking Space Fleets, Honor Harrington, Miles Vorkosigan, etc. So when we get a good story from an author whose work I like that happens to be young adult military SF, no isn't my first answer. Ergo, we present Navy Brat by Kay Kenyon. Miss Kenyon lives in Washington State. She's appeared here before with the stories The Acid Test and The Last Wave, and she's making waves now with a very grand space adventure trilogy, The Entire and The Rose. It has colliding galaxies. How much cooler do you need? The third novel, City Without End, will be available from Pyre next February. This story first appeared in the anthology Space Cadets, which was a special release at the 2006 Worldcon. The story is read for us by my favorite political podcaster, Danny Cutler. Danny's Truth Seekers podcast offers thoughtful analysis and a strong community. I call it left-leaning moderate, but without intolerance for other points of view. I understand there's something going on right now in the U.S. with some sort of public office or something. Regardless of where you stand, it's a good time to get informed on the issues, and Danny will help you do that at audioaddicts.libsyn.com. So form up and stand at attention. It's story time.
Navy Brat by Kay Kenyon. Candidates, form up, barked the sergeant. 16-year-old cadet Marie Caro and her fellow juniors lined up as best they could in zero-G in the forward hold of the largest generation ship ever seen, the Centauri. 400 years out from Earth, the Centauri was the only ship Marie and her shipmates have ever known. Candidates, show honor! Marie and her fellow classmates bowed in unison in the aft direction to the place of honor, the Admiral's historical quarters in the stern of the ship. But the Admiral had been dead 350 years, and Marie thought it was time to get over it. Having bowed in, the cadets commenced in the practice session in the zero-G well, simulating the hull environment, where ship's forces skirmished with their most recent and determined enemy, called mutts for their quadruped form. The Centauri had fought off other alien attacks, but those had been long ago. Just when Marie and her shipmates thought the voyage could continue in peace, the mutts found them. The mutts, with their round ships bristling with armor, made it clear that they claimed this sector of space and tolerated no trespassing. Fending off attacks, the ship voyaged on to that distant star cluster where they hoped to find a planet and a new home. Navy's job was to be sure nobody tried to stop them. Marie grinned through her visor at Josie, one of the few women like herself, tall enough to be Navy. "Looking good, Josie," Marie said, eyeing her friend, who was just as pleased as Marie to be wearing regulation Navy. No cadet suits for zero-G. Everyone wore the same NV rigs, rendering them blurry to the enemy, if not really invisible. Supple, bioactive, and expensive, the suits kicked mutt and made Marie feel like she was already real Navy, even if she was still just a junior cadet. She pushed off when her turn came, floating into the huge hold where she had to keep her line from tangling with other lines and stay alert for the seniors whose job it was to kill you with their dye guns. In the well, as throughout the ship, patches of enlivened hulls showed the view of near space through remote sensing. Here in the well, it was disorienting. Marie went into a tumble, then controlled it with the spray from her backpack. Through her enhanced visor, she could see her own team, spread out, their suits clear to her, but not to the seniors. A few of her team wore blue armbands, not regulation, but overlooked more and more these days. Blue for the Admiral. Blue for veneration. Blue for sucking up to the brass. Even before reaching the length of her tether, Marie's suit registered a lock-on from a dye gun. Using reflexes honed from 1,000 hours of submission fighting, she cranked off an elbow shot from her distributed suit armor, then yanked her tether to give her a roll, sensing another lock from behind. "Quarter-round spray!" she hollered needlessly from her suit, and the dye squirted out, tagging the assailant behind her. Immediately, the suit dumped her excess heat and injected a dose of Costropone to amp up her reaction time. But the engagement was over. She'd won. Nearby, Josie offered assistance, barking, "Gun to bear, 301. "No need. Target's out, 220. Josie had offered her gun, but both of them knew she was really offering congratulations. Firing backpack nozzles, Marie squirted in from the well, clamping onto the catwalk. She looked at Sergeant Liu. He wasn't smiling. "Where's your armband, Cadet Caro?" he said over the mic. "With respect, not regulation, sir." He spat out. "Answer the question, Cadet." "Sir, I don't have an armband." Just then the lieutenant clamped by, feet locking on to the metal grid. "Nice work, Caro," he said as he passed. And that was the end of the blue band discussion. For now. Josie and Marie peeled off their invies and rubbed down with biocloths, donning their dress whites for the assembly. Buttoning up, Marie staggered as someone pushed her against the lockers, swiping a hand across her breasts for a quick thrill. Marie whirled to smack him, then pulled the punch. It was Senior Rhodes. If she had hit him, she would be a civilian within the hour. "Sir!" she came to attention. "Sorry to be in the way, sir!" "Yeah, we're all sorry you're in the way, Caro." He grinned at the other senior, but there was nothing happy about his expression. She'd taken him in the fight, him and his buddy, 2-on-1. As the senior sauntered out, Marie saw that Rhodes had smeared her white shirt with dye. It would never do for the ceremony investing Colonel Savat as Academy Commander. Josie had left, but soon she was back with a clean shirt. "Belongs to Aaron. She's in sickbay." Now 4 minutes behind, the two women scrambled to button up, spruce up, and hydrate with a swig of water. Everything in Navy was timed. Everything was regulation. It was demanding, but Marie wouldn't have it any other way. One of her civvy friends had said, "Why go military with all those pimping yes-sirs, no-sirs?" She didn't have a quick answer then, but she did now. Because you give up a little of yourself to get bigger than yourself. That was Navy. They threw on their short capes to complete parade dress and exited the lockers double time, heading past mess and into the main corridor bound for the mustering area. "Here," Josie said, handing her something balled up in her fist. It was a blue band. "Go ahead. It doesn't mean void, Marie. Just wear it. Colonel Zavat's a big blue, you know. Come on." Marie didn't bother to argue. She smashed the armband into her pants pocket. If Josie wanted to venerate a dead admiral, she could go ahead. That's not what Navy is about. It's about protecting the ship so that 9,000 colonists could get to the Alpha Centauri cluster, put down roots, and do so with the benefits of civilization and the rule of law. She had memorized the answers for her oral exams, but she believed them, too. Sometimes it seemed that others didn't. It was as though they'd given up on the dream of a planet home. There was only the ship. Its history was the only history that mattered. The stars toward which they sped were as distant as Earth's sun, a mere speck of light in the immense starfield left behind. When they got to the reviewing grounds, Sergeant Liu was counting heads and glaring for Josie and Marie to take their places. They marched into formation, standing at formal ease, waiting for Colonel Savat to arrive. He appeared with a pack of adjutants and officers who followed him onto the field in front of the assembled Navy personnel and civilian guests. "Attention!" called Sergeant Liu. Those in uniform snapped to. "Honors!" he called out. Those assembled, even a few of the civvies, bowed aft, then faced the new commanders. "Navy personnel at ease," Colonel James Savat said, his voice enhanced by his suit mics. With his white blonde hair, everything about Savat looked pale as a vat fish's belly, except for his blue eyes, eyes fervent with allegiance to the admiral. Worship, some would say. At the command to be at ease, the cadets threw their capes over their right shoulder instead of wearing them over both. When the maneuver was complete, Marie's stomach fell. In row upon row in front of her, every left arm bore a blue armband. Savat was well into his speech before Marie could even focus on what he was saying. The last thing she wanted was to draw his attention. She was soon past worrying. Savat noticed her. 301, stand forward, Savat ordered. Marie stepped briskly through the lines, praying for a mutt incursion, praying to hear the klaxon blaring. But the only enemy today was standing right in front of her. The adjutant leaned in, giving Savat her name. Cadet Caro, what happened to your armband?
I don't have one, sir.
I see that. Why don't you have one? Marie's throat was so dry it fell glued shut.
It's not regulation, sir.
Do you know what esprit de corps means, cadet?
You may answer. It means the spirit of the group, sir.
Precisely.
Do you contribute to the spirit of your class, cadet? Do you venerate the admiral and foundation of the Navy service? Those were a lot of questions, and not all of them had the same answer. "Yes, sir," she said. "I've heard that you do not. I've heard that you're not proper in the eyes of the Admiral, that you're not a believer in the foundation of this ship and the memory of Admiral von Essen." "With respect, sir, I do honor Admiral von Essen's memory, but I don't worship him." Marie now faced a group of officers who looked at her as though she was a mutt. Savat's voice fell on her like a blow. "You worship yourself? Isn't that right, cadet?" Without allowing her to answer, he went on. "What keeps this ship of 9,000 from falling into factions, chaos, and immortality? Did we not ages ago choose to leave our Earth-based religions behind for the sake of ship unity? And did we not come to the revelation that Admiral von Essen was our guiding light and supreme lord?" To her horror, she heard herself say, "No, sir, I didn't choose that, sir." She knew there was no regulation about a supreme lord. Maybe in the new navy there soon would be. She didn't know what she believed in a religious sense. But one thing she did know, God was not a dead admiral. Savat dismissed her with a gesture of contempt laced with pity. Marie walked back to her place. But it was just a temporary rest. She didn't have a place in the navy anymore. Savat would make sure of that. In the days after her dismissal from the navy, Marie wandered ship's halls, trying to get used to civilian ways. The guilds that tutored select students in technology, the cabin clusters forming distinctive neighborhoods and the diverse households. Vatborn, Marie had no family grouping. The ship tolerated all styles of living. You could be family-born or free-born like Marie. You could be tech-trained or plain-taught, navy or regular, and no one sneered. The one exception? No religion to divide the community and censor the science that kept them alive. But now, under the guise of historical veneration, the Admiralty was becoming a religion. No one would dare call it that, just as no one would dare call her a washout. It didn't change the facts. Marie wandered. She avoided the civilian residential decks, preferring the industrial holds and nano-assembly pallets where her boots echoed off bare hull and hard vats, and she could walk forever, even if it was in circles. Sometimes she saw Captain Benwan Ahu in the corridors. People respected him and his steady leadership, but no one tried making a god of him. Once there had been two leaders, the captain and the fleet admiral who used the Centauri as his flagship. There came the day when the fleet dispersed, each generation ship heading on its separate trajectory toward promising star systems. The tradition of the admiral continued during Admiral von Essen's lifetime, a beloved transition of the grand old man who advised the captain and maintained links with other ships until they were too remote for communications. When had the admiral become a figure of devotion? And why was Marie incapable of such piety? As Colonel Savat has said, it helped with navy esprit de corps. The admiral was the foundation of the service, worthy of veneration. Nope, she couldn't see it. Today, Josie joined Marie's walk. As they approached the Admiral's shrine, Marie noticed blue ribbons tied to the emergency handholds along the corridor leading to the Admiral's sealed doors. The blue streamers were spreading like a virus. Josie bowed to the door. Marie didn't. She ran her hands along the captain's seal that formally shut the doors to the Admiral's suite. No one had been inside since von Essen died. No one had replaced him. The fleet by then was scattered among the stars. Josie looked nervously around. Better not touch those. Marie did, though. She looked up at the inscription over the doors. By the light of the earth, by the light of the stars. It was a pledge and a vision. And it didn't mean void anymore. Marie kicked at the door in disgust. Let's go, Josie said. I have to be back on mission deck at 1600. Right. The Navy waited. But what kind of Navy? Afterwards, Marie couldn't remember what finally drove her, weeks later and deep in sleep cycle, to break the seals on the Admiral's doors and enter the sanctuary. There was no ship law saying she couldn't enter. And what could they do to her that would be worse than they had already done? Still, she closed the door behind her. She stood very quiet on the thick carpet in the sanctuary of the Admiral's suite. The furnishings were spare and elegant. She breathed deeply to let the spirit of the place penetrate her, as it seemed to have done for so many. Why did she resist bowing to the memory of a dead officer? If people wanted to elevate von Essen to something big and serious, why couldn't she just go along? Maybe if she touched the Admiral's things, she'd get a jolt of belief. Maybe then she could find her place on the ship, with Navy or without. She parted the velvet drapes of the bulkhead, where an enlivened patch showed the stunning local starscape. Usually beautiful, it now looked sinister and lonely. Turning away from the bulkhead, she ran her hand along a dust-coated armoire, along a table with antique star charts, and, on the other side of the room, a shelf with lovely sculptures. But she felt no stirrings of awe. Here was the Admiral's cabin, full of history, lore, and beauty, but nothing of God. Von Essen's sleeping chamber held a modest, military-style pallet. She imagined him lying down to sleep, his head filled with weighty matters of ships, the fleet, and God. She whirled, hearing the snap of something behind her. Someone stood in the door to the sitting room. Dressed in blue and gold, with a regulation crease in his trouser legs and the requisite number of stars on his collar, Admiral Von Essen had caught her trespassing. In the next instant, she saw that he was a projection. "No time," the image said, looking quickly to one side. "No time. I've barred the door, but they're coming anyway. Listen, whoever you are. My officers are against transition. They're afraid to lose their privileges. They want me to use emergency powers to turn on our own people. I've refused. They've imprisoned me in quarters, damn them to hell. Even worse, they've given out a myth of my infallibility. It's nonsense. We would have weathered transitioned, and all would have found their place, high or low. Of that I have no doubt." He looked in alarm to one side, where a thumping could be heard, where the officers were beating down the door. "Look for yourself. Don't be afraid." A crashing noise covered his words and killed the projection. That must have been the moment when Von Essen died. Stunned, Marie sat on the edge of the bed. The Admiral a prisoner? The Admiral a victim of officers' conspiracy? He never wanted to be venerated, much less adored. They had used him then, and they were using him now. What were they afraid would happen? What was the transition they so feared? Had the Techs found a way to faster-than-light speeds? Made some contact with an alien force? "Look for yourself," Von Essen had said. Marie intended to. Quickly, she searched the quarters for some evidence of what transition might be. Very late in the sleep cycle, she found her evidence, as she sat in the Admiral's desk, deep in his optic computer files. Here were the master controls to which all other computers in the ship were slaved, as well as comm systems, enlivened bulkheads, and data storage. Here she found the toggle from simulated to real. She stepped to the bulkheads and pushed back the velvet drapes as far as they would go. She flipped the toggle. In glorious formation before her, a planet appeared on screen. Yellow continents, ice-capped poles, green ocean laced with intricate clouds. The Centauri had arrived. By the light of the stars, ship had come to a new home. Marie figured out an override for the smart walls and computer images people had been watching for so long. She hit real in the Admiral's simple command index. With growing elation, Marie stood in front of the Admiral's aft wall, staring at the real-time view of the magnificent planet turning below them. Ship was in orbit. How long they had been here, she couldn't guess. Perhaps their approach was the reason for the Mutt hostilities. Maybe there'd be less of that if the Centauri could speak freely to the inhabitants of the world below. She heard footsteps sprinting down the corridor outside. Outraged voices, civilian and navy. Flinging the doors open, Captain Ahu's henchmen rushed in, dragging her out of the Admiral's chair. So it wasn't just Navy that was afraid of the new world. The captain, too. As Marie awaited her fate in the ship's brig, the guards made sure she didn't talk to anyone. But it was too late to halt transition. Marie had sent the Admiral's file all over the ship, to every computer node, to every bulkhead screen pretending to show local space. She could hear the commotion through the decking. The ship was alive with protest, first small and then growing, to a profound clamor for the truth. On the third day of her confinement, her guards walked away, leaving the door unlocked. Marie walked free of the ship's brig. 200 days later, Josie and Marie stood side by side, both in the uniform of Navy. On the opposite side of the corridor stood the Navy personnel who would not go groundside, who preferred to continue on to other stars. Joining them were numerous civilians who had voted to stay. All wore blue armbands, still claiming a divine mission. The planet belonged to heathen mutts, so the Blues said. Well, it belonged to the Kree, as the Centauri had learned, but the land was vast and the Kree would share. It took 200 days to work out the terms, but the Kree suspended hostilities and entered into a treaty. The Centauri was now called the Von Essen. It still amazed Marie that so many chose to stay on board. They might never find a destination, but most believed the Admiral would reveal it in due course. They had faith. Colonel Savat stood among the Blues. his fanaticism undimmed. But those without armbands were getting ready to shuttle groundside, and that included Marie and Josie. The transition to the planet would be hard. They'd come in peace, but there were no guarantees that they'd be welcomed, no promises of heaven on Earth. There was only the planet, a new gravity and a new life. It was a shame Von Essen hadn't lived long enough to join in, but Marie was looking forward to the challenge. Josie nodded at her friend. Ready? Marie grinned, stepping into the waiting shuttle. Ready.
And that was our story. This is another one that I find far too believable. It's just as easy for cultures to get caught up in their beliefs about themselves and to feel a need to preserve the status quo as individual people. We all have our blind spots where an injection of reality is the last thing we might want. Even if it's negative emotion, we'd sometimes rather hold on to the bad stuff we know about rather than dive into reassessing everything. So let's do some feedback. Escape Pod 173, Mike Resnick's story, Robots Don't Cry, made some of our audience cry. This was the piece about future antique scavengers who uncover a robot who relates the tale of a girl with a tragic life. This one was about 70-30, whether it worked for people. Plenty of folks said it did bring tears, or at least came close to it. DKT wrote, "Whenever another Resnick story pops up in the feed, I feel like it's almost daring me to get emotional, and I'm betting I won't. Most of the time, Resnick wins. He certainly did this time." Many, such as Devil's Advocate, recognized that the story was stereotypical or directly emotionally manipulative, but it got to them anyway. For some others, it didn't. Many just said, as Calculating did, touching but not tear-worthy. Others were more critical. Some felt that Miss Emily's troubles were so overplayed as to cross over into parody. As Cerebralith wrote, quote, "She's covered in horrible fungus, she's rejected in love, the family farm goes bust time and again, her parents die, her world dies, she rejects her off-world family because she feels they're too good to be burdened with her, she's covered in pustules, she goes blind, she dies alone with the robot who's only there because he was built to be." Steph thought it sounded very Book of Job. Once again, thanks to everyone who commented. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. All other rights are reserved by our authors. If you like this week's story, please tell a friend or blog about us. Do not, repeat, do not start a religion. The invisible pink unicorns are jealous creatures. But you can, if you'd like to help us support our authors, consider donating via the PayPal link on our site, escapepod.org. Also check out our sister podcasts, Podcastle and Pseudopod, flying to the furthest reaches of their genres at their .org domains. Our music is by permission of Daikaiju. You can hear more from them at daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. Our closing quotation, I decided I wanted to run a quotation from a famous admiral, and Lord Nelson came immediately to mind, but I remembered a better one. Admiral Yi Sun Shin, arguably the greatest hero in Korean history, who repelled the invasion from Japan in the 1590s and created the world's first ironclad ships, the turtle ships. He summarized his success as follows, quote, "My life is simple, my food is plain, and my quarters are uncluttered. In all things, I have sought clarity. I face the troubles and problems of life and death willingly. Virtue, integrity, and courage are my priorities. I can be approached, but never pushed. Befriended, but never coerced. Killed, but never shamed." He also once said, "A soldier who fights to the death never dies, but a soldier who fights merely for existence never truly exists." We'll see you next week. Until then, have fun.